Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. It's another wonderful week in South Africa. Today, I'm joined by Mr. Tiego Tsotse. Tiego, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, thanks, and how are you, Nick, sir? Good afternoon, Mr. Terence.
I'm pretty good. I had a nasty flu over the weekend, but it has cleared up already, and so I'm fit and fighting and ready to get back into the action. And of course, we're also joined by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you, sir?
No, I'm good, I'm good. There's some background noise here. Just bear that in mind.
Cool. Yeah, no, I must apologize for those watching on video. I haven't quite sorted out my background yet, which is a bit dull, lifeless, and ugly, but hopefully I can get it looking a bit better soon. But that's neither here nor there. Let us get into the news stories of today. And I think the big one, probably the one that's going to be making the big headlines today, is the Supreme Court of Appeal has ruled on the matter of Jacob Zuma and his medical parole. So there was a lot of question as to whether Jacob Zuma should have in fact been released on medical parole after 2 months. This came because apparently, despite the fact that the parole board said that Zuma should not be released because he wasn't sick enough, Arthur Fraser, the head of the correctional services at the time, said that he should be and overruled the parole board. Anyway, it's been through the courts, and the Supreme Court of Appeal has returned its ruling. Said, quote, Mr. Zuma in law has not finished serving his sentence. He must return to the escort correctional center to do so, it said in a unanimous judgment on Monday. But how long he stays there was not a matter for the courts to decide. This was a matter to be considered by the Commissioner of Correctional Services. If he's empowered in law to do so, the Commissioner might take the period already spent on medical parole into account to determining any applications or grounds for release, according to the Justice. The president had been sentenced to, of course, 15 months in prison for contempt of court for refusing to listen to the Constitutional Court when it had ordered him to attend the State Capture Commission. So this case was brought by the DA, the Helen Sussman Foundation, AfriForum. We also joined as an amicus the IRR did rather to make a contribution on the law here, which has been explained in a previous episode, but we're not going to get too much into that. So, Terence, what do you make of this? Does this mean that Zuma is back into jail? Don't pass, begin, don't go anywhere. You're going straight to jail. No chance to get out of this. I see that apparently the thing will be suspended if he appeals to the Constitutional Court. Do you think he's going to appeal this?
Do I think he's going to appeal this? Yes. Will Zuma go to prison? Yeah, maybe, you know, lots of things. Maybe I'll sprout wings and fly. Maybe, from prison from a poser will show that he actually was playing this four-dimensional game of chess and, he is a great reformer. I just wouldn't bet it. As far as Zuma goes, no, I think this will likely be shown to be a paper victory. I don't think that there is any willingness on the part of anyone who matters to see him in prison. I think the courts kind of I think with due deference here to the principle of separation of powers, I don't think they particularly wanted to have this load of steaming material landing on their lap, so they pass it over to the correctional commissioner, who I'm pretty sure doesn't particularly want to have to deal with it anyway. I'm sure that there will be something that will allow our esteemed former president to contest some minor technicality on the spelling mistake on page 17 of the judgment or something like that. That's just how we roll here in the demented republic.
There's a sort of eternal joke with Zuma, which is that everyone goes, ah, we've got him now, and then he wriggles out of it, and it's like, oh well, nevertheless. I suspect that the fact that there is still another court to appeal to, even though it's a court that is, shall we say, not well disposed to Zuma, considering that the thing in question here is whether he should be serving a sentence for contempt of the constitutional court. So it's going to be a bit awkward to appeal to the constitutional court on this.
Yeah, and but, that probably gives him another reason to appeal.
Right,
again.
Exactly, exactly.
I don't really see this one panning out all that well.
Nonetheless, it does seem to me like his star is fading even within the ANC. There was a while ago, very recently, you know, within the last year, where Zuma still had a lot of people, particularly in the KZN ANC, speaking up for him. But now it looks like the party's moving away from his chosen candidates. It's moving towards Zweli Mkhize. It's moving, at least the anti-Ramaphosa faction, is moving in a different direction. And I think that they're not as keen on Zuma as they once were. I don't know. Tiego, what do you make of this story? Do you think I'm correct in that assessment?
No, I think you're very much correct. The thing about ANC politics is that the people who influence branches, regions, provinces, and stuff of that nature, a lot of times it's people who want to chow. The main question they are interested in is how do we eat? And so because Zuma is out of office now, he's been out for a while, hasn't been giving them anything of that nature, then they automatically move. Such is the nature of what ANC politics have become. It's no longer about content. It's about who can feed us and who has support, who looks like they could win and provide us with that. Regarding Zuma himself, I think by now it's quite clear that his strategy as far as the courts are concerned is to run away as much as possible. At his age now, I'm sure he's planning on running away till the day God remembers him. I'm sure that's the whole strategy, to run away until he passes on. I don't think there's any strategy beyond this. But anyway, I think this is a good judgment that must be welcomed.
No, very much so. Terence, any final thoughts before we move on?
Nah. No, it's just like we've been here before. You know, no, it's. I do think actually you're correct. I think he's become something of a liability now. You know, unless maybe your surname is Niehaus, I don't think that there is a huge that there is a huge fan base anymore.
Certainly not
for those who are more transactional in their approach. That, you know, Zuma could deliver the patronage or deliver the, you know, popularity or whatever. And I think the sense that some people, you know, get away with all manner of things is actually quite rubs up a lot of South Africans who might, you know, rubs up the wrong way, even those who might have been willing to sort of overlook it the first 15 or 16 times.
Yeah, no, I'd like to meet that person who's okay with Zuma wriggling out of it the first 16 times, but it's now had enough of it. Anyway, interesting to watch. I actually think there is a chance that he may reach the end of his legal road, in a sense, here at some point. Just because that balance is shifting and the ANC no longer has the use for him that it once did. But we shall see. We shall see. That story has been told many times, and every time Zuma has once again gotten out a new lease on life. All right. So our President Cyril Ramaphosa is soon going to be meeting with British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak for discussions between the two countries on their relations. And apparently, according to Ramaphosa's office, one of the primary objectives of the meeting is for Ramaphosa to try and get the sanctions lifted on Zimbabwe. According to Ramaphosa's special advisor on international relations, Maropene Ramakgopa, who told Times Live this is going to be very much on the agenda, they said that, quote, the sanctions are affecting South Africa in a very difficult way. The reason there is a lot of migration from Zimbabwe is because people are running away from economic hardships. It's not because they want to leave home, and the sanctions are not assisting in any way. So we'd like them to look at it differently. Interesting. But actually, this is a narrative that's often spilled out by, say, the EFF or people of the ANC about saying that, you know, Zimbabwe's problems with their economy is not due to policy. No, it's all due to sanctions by the West. So I was like, okay, well, let me actually go and look up what the sanctions are. And the sanctions, according to at least the U.S. Treasury Department, and I believe the British pretty much copied the U.S. in this manner, they block the property and interests in property of individuals and entities listed in the sanctions list. So there's a whole list of people which we won't go through, but essentially you're not allowed to do business with any entity that is 50% owned by or wholly owned by a senior official of the government of Zimbabwe, controlled directly or indirectly by the government of Zimbabwe, or an official or officials of the government of Zimbabwe have engaged in actions or policies to undermine Zimbabwe's democratic processes or institutions, someone who has been responsible for or participated in human rights abuses related to political repression in Zimbabwe, or has engaged in activities facilitating public corruption by senior officials of the government of Zimbabwe. You also can't do business with any of their family members. So in other words, the sanctions have been drafted very much to, as specifically as possible, target government officials and the government itself rather than private business. Now, granted, in a very poor country like Zimbabwe, the government is quite a large chunk of sort of what's going on in state activities. But this really kind of, I think, highlights the point here, which is that, to my mind, what Ramaphosa is doing is he's going to be asking Rishi Sunak to take sanctions off of ZANU-PF and the corrupt ZANU-PF regime, which holds power undemocratically in Zimbabwe. Tiego, what do you make of all this?
Well, firstly, something I don't understand is why Mnangagwa cannot go to the UK himself and have that discussion with the government that side. How do we get the sanctions lifted from Zimbabwe, take it from there, change your policies, come up with good policies? I agree with you completely that Zimbabwe is failing fundamentally because of policies and not because of sanctions against those individuals. If anything, if Zimbabwe had good policies and those sanctions remained, I think Zimbabwe would do quite well, because to a certain extent, that would stop corruption to a certain extent, I'd like to believe. If anything, I wish we had such sanctions imposed against some of our politicians in South Africa. Yeah, then perhaps we'd be a bit far as a country. But what I make of the whole thing, Ramaphosa, I wonder what message he's trying to send out there. That's a fundamental thing that's in my head right now. Number one, in terms of the policy positions of Zimbabwe, what is he saying about the policies if he's not going to Zimbabwe and saying to the Zimbabwean government, reconsider your policies, but is able to go to the UK and say, reconsider your sanctions without saying to this one, reconsider your policies? Is it that he supports the policies? That's number one. Number two, the question of corruption and the ZANU-PF government, a government that really, a very abusive government to the people. It abuses its people on a daily basis. What is he saying about them? Why should those sanctions be removed from them? Is he in support of such a government? Those are the questions running through my mind right now. Yeah,
I think that's exactly right. Terence, are we being too harsh in dismissing this argument that the sanctions aren't to blame for the large number of Zimbabweans coming to South Africa? What do you make of this?
Oh, well, I think that it takes a considerable leap of logic to think that this is about, you know, the suffering millions of Zimbabwe. The ANC's position on Zimbabwe has, and you read their own documents on this, been largely a function of their sense of solidarity with a fellow liberation movement. To the extent this is about Zimbabwe, it is about the fact that Zimbabwe is a country and ZANU-PF are seen as coterminous. And, you know, this goes back to Mbeki's quiet diplomacy. Andrew Feinstein leaked Mbeki's remarks to the ANC parliamentary caucus that they would have nothing to do with the MDC because that was all a CIA plant. And I think this was taken, you know, semi-seriously, you know, in his own mind, because after all, the party that not only represents but embodies the true spirit of the people, the liberation movement, cannot betray them. You know, it calls to mind Bertolt Brecht's remark about the East German government: why didn't they just dissolve the people and elect themselves a new one? You know, in as far as, you know, the Zimbabwean refugees being in South Africa, I think a lot of that has to, also has to do with the fact that neither the good burghers of this country nor the South African government particularly want them here. But, you know, in a pecking order of priorities, you know, they would rather have the economic damage to South Africa. They would, you know, they would rather have the refugee crisis. They would rather even put up with the discontent of a population, a voting base that's not particularly wild about people with strange accents, then betray their ideological soul brothers. I think that pretty much explains it. It's what, you know, what they say, when all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Where your worldview is fundamentally and overwhelmingly political, and doesn't appear along any other given axis, then that is the way you see it. And clearly, the one thing that South Africa can do to intervene in this is to plead for these sanctions to be removed. Whether that has any impact or not is less important than that it supports a particular narrative, which is almost more real than reality.
Right. I mean, it's absolutely maddening that we continue to carry water for ZANU-PF, you know, after all these years. And of course, this is one more point I want to make, which is that while most Zimbabweans, I'm sure, are here for economic reasons because of the collapse of that country's economy, there are significant numbers here who are here for other reasons too: fear of political violence, fear of ethnic violence. Let's not forget that it was the ZANU-PF government of Zimbabwe that carried out the so-called Kukuruhundi in Zimbabwe, where it killed thousands of Ndebele people across the country in what some have called a genocide. This is not a regime that you can do business with. And I know Ndebele people from Zimbabwe who are here because they say, well, we're not going back to live in that place, where we have this maniacal, insane government that torments us all the time. So it's not just economic problems. And if you can lift all the sanctions you like, and it's not going to stop those people fleeing that nightmare regime. Anyway, Tiako, any final thoughts?
Well, I agree with everything that you've said. Also agree with everything that Terence has said. That would be my final thoughts right there.
Oh no, we're agreeing too much. Okay, let's quickly get to the next topic. there is currently a taxi strike underway in Cape Town. The South African National Taxi Association has embarked on a protest in response to the suspension of the city's Blue Dot Taxi Initiative, which rewards good behavior and passenger service due to a lack of funding. Apparently, there have been two buses burnt and an attempted hijacking of a third. The city suggests, as in connection with the protests, but it seems as though the impact of the protests has been relatively limited so far, with most of the violence being kind of kept in Khayelitsha so far, where the taxis are most active, it seems. Still not great for the people of Khayelitsha to have, you know, buses being burned down and that kind of thing. Apparently there were undercover cops on the bus that was attempted to be hijacked, and they managed to foil the hijacking as it sort of took place. But still, crazy stuff. Terence, what do you make of this? I mean, you know, I kind of often begin to think that in South Africa, it's really the taxi associations that run lots of the country. And they really do seem to be able to bring a lot of force to bear. I don't know. What are your thoughts on the story?
There's something quite postmodern about this. You suspend a program that rewards good behavior and things get torched. You know, make of that what you will.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, oh, you don't want us to behave well anymore. All right. Well, we'll show you bad behavior.
I think that the taxi industry illustrates, in a sense, the best and the worst of South Africa. You know, on the one hand, a lot of entrepreneurship, people who manage to take a situation that was part opportunity, part desperation, and make it work fairly efficiently. On the other hand, you know, for a long time, that was one of the few avenues through which enterprising Black people could get ahead. So it's always been incredibly competitive. And because of that, it has also had its very bloody borders. Taxi wars, you know, been going on for ages. Those who remember the ANC-IFP civil war in the 1990s, remember that taxi associations were also a layer on top of that, sometimes opportunistically, sometimes because they tend, you know, this one tended to split that way, this one tended to split the other way. It's not a happy situation, but we've made this point that as the South African state finds itself unable to actually control the territory over which it nominally presides, people will look for other people who can. This is just a phenomenon throughout history. You know, if NATO won't guard you from Somalian pirates, you know, the Russian Navy or the Chinese Navy will step in, and then you bitch about the fact that you've got this, you know, anti-democratic presence there. Well, you know, if the cops can't protect you when there's an uprising because a certain former president went to prison, something which we discussed earlier in the show, well, you know, maybe it's the taxi industry that's going to step into the breach and you know, force you to leave Mponya Mall. Was it the Mponya Mall, I think, alone, because that was where they did a lot of their business. There's also been cases where taxi bosses and local farmers have teamed up because they both find themselves very vulnerable. Taxi drivers carry a lot of cash, and you know, they have the muscle, and the farmers have the communication and the infrastructure. And apparently, in some places, that's actually worked quite well. But fundamentally, what this all comes down to is the state not doing its job. You know, that means that you know, other people have to fit into areas where they don't have the mandate, and where their interventions can have, as we say, externalities.
So, Teho, I'm like Terence. Like, you know, I kind of see very much the duality of the taxi system. You know, it's this incredible, mostly decentralized structure which has gotten millions of South Africans to the places they need to be at relatively low costs for decades and decades. This should be a great triumph, and yet it's permeated by this violence and this chaos. And I really think that one of the other big problems here, apart from the state not doing its job, in this case law enforcement, in this case providing transport, that kind of thing, is that the strike culture in this country is not healthy. And we don't just see it in the public sector, although it's very much there, but we see it in the fact that every time a mine goes on strike, there's often people getting killed, or people getting abused, or people getting chased around. Diego, do you agree with me on that point? And if so, you know, how do we get out of this bind of people thinking that the way you strike is by intimidating others?
Well, I agree completely that there's too many strikes taking place in the country, too much violence around the strikes as well every now and then. I think it will vary from one case to another. If the strikes, for example, have to do with issues that are between the employer and the employee, I think what could happen, scraping off, bringing back powers of an employment contract back to the employer and the employee, that would assist a lot. So say that negotiations in say it's a department, I'm just going to give a quick example. Say it's a department or it's a private company. So it's a private company, they've hired me on the basis of my own contract. There shouldn't be a union that then comes in and says that they are coming there to represent a collective of people, whereas it was an individual who signed the contract with the individual understanding with the employer and stuff of that nature. So I think if we try to get rid of the trade unions as much as possible, for example, in the employment sector, then you'd have less strikes, because you wouldn't have to strike as a collective. You'd have to negotiate for your own terms, conditions, and stuff of that nature with your employer directly. If you don't agree with the terms and conditions, you leave. Go look for a job somewhere else. If the employer cannot, for example, afford the salary ask that you are making at that point. You are unhappy with your increment and stuff of that nature. So I think it's too broad a topic. It would have to deal with each topic and its particular merits and how it can be dealt with. But I do think, if I may just conclude, I do think that, yeah, I agree with Terence that a lot of these things are happening due to government's failures to hold the law. I mean, when you live in a country and you know that you can strike, ban things, there will be no consequences and stuff of that nature, you continue doing exactly that. But if we had a government that was working and people were held to account, whether you're a citizen in a suburb, rural areas, townships or whatnot, if you do anything out of the law, pay for it. Be held accountable. I think then that would stop these things from moving forward. Regarding the taxi industry, this now I'm really concluding. Regarding the taxi industry, I agree with you and Terence that there's a good story about them to celebrate. Then there's another bad story to celebrate. I remember when the bus system was introduced by the city of Tshwane in Pretoria. It must have been back in 2014 or so. I don't recall quite well. They protested, banned buses at that very time. When now here in Polokwane it's being introduced, the same system, they want to ban the buses. It's happening in the Western Cape. When Uber came around, when Taxify came around, they stopped the drivers from operating, banned some of them, banned their cars, took their cars. My brother, as an example, was driving an Uber car just last year. They caught him making a pickup there at Pretoria bus station and demanded that he gives them 2,500 or they ban his car. So the taxis, it's surprising. They came into the industry, they created this thing, but now they don't want competition anymore. They want to keep it to themselves. Anyone who comes and competes, the violence is the response to it, which is not right. Government should do something about that.
Definitely. All right. I don't know if we have proper time for our last story here about fracking, but I think, yeah, let's just very quickly breeze through it. I'll just go to Terence a little bit on this one. It looks like Energy and Mining Minister Gwede Mantashe has produced a plan, or at least his department has produced a plan, which is going to be looking at doing seismic studies and possibly drilling for gas through the process of fracking in the Greater Karoo Basin. Now, this is a very contentious topic. It's been faced a lot of opposition from people within the Karoo, and also from, I think, AfriForum was even involved in fighting against it and that sort of thing, and as well as a lot of environmental groups. So the news stories covering it, quite a lot of environmental groups talking about this. But Terence, my sense is if environmental regulations are adhered to correctly, I don't see why we shouldn't be getting every single possible economic resource we can at this stage. What are your thoughts on this topic?
Look, I tend, and I'm told by some people a lot more about it, to be skeptical of fracking. I'm told that my concerns are rational. They don't seem around groundwater, but supposedly my concerns are not well merited. I don't know enough about it, but I think this is the sort of quandary we find ourselves in. We are stuck in an essentially no growth trajectory, if for no other reason than we don't have energy. If this is a means by which that can be in part alleviated, then it seems to be something that we should explore. I think perhaps where the argument the environmental lobby is missing out on is, can you trust the government as it exists to actually ensure that those environmental regulations are adhered to? We are just not going to be able to make that transition to renewables in any kind of time horizon that gives us a fighting chance of getting hold of problems like unemployment. And when I say getting hold of, I mean, can we sort of edge it down towards 20%?
Yeah, would be nice.
So then again, Gwede Mantashe did not fare well in the Zondo Commission. So when you know one has to, as we say, this raises questions.
Very much so. Okay, very last story, just for a bit of a laugh. Reported at IOL, a pug was found on a passenger airline in the United States. A comedian was flying from Nashville to California, I believe, and she woke up to the flight attendant holding a pug in her hands and demanding to know from the passengers who it belonged to. Said, quote, on Twitter, this is from Laura Peake, the comedian, "My flight today, I woke up from a nap and an attendant was walking down the aisles holding a pug, saying, 'We found this pug. Whose pug is it?' And for 3 hours, we all just took turns holding the mystery pugs, the pug, until a very stoned man in the last row woke up and said, was like, 'Roscoe,' which is apparently the pug's name." Terrence, as the proud owner of pugs, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I always maintain, you know, if you have a pug, that is the true master of the house. Respect the pug is what I said. It just amazes me that a country that, you know, for the last 20 years has been so anal retentive about airline security, you know, after 9/11. Yeah, pug life, they are awesome. I didn't choose the pug life. The pug life chose me. You know, how do you get one of the world's most recognizable, noisy, farting, you know, excitable breeds onto that plane and, you know, not notice the 3 hours that it's gone? You know, no matter how stoned you are, surely the fact that your bug is running up and down. Yeah, I don't know.
The mysteries. It also really brings into question what the airport security system in the US is doing, considering how incredibly jackbooted and thorough it is that they didn't notice the bug be brought in anyway. Okay, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on, and thank you to everyone for listening. We hope that you thought that it was interesting, and we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful afternoon.